Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Tuesday edition. Today's date's the 29th day of April, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another installment of the French Connection. Lots to share with you today. Got an interview with a regular guest of ours, a returning guest, somebody who always adds great value to the information we've always been sharing with you. His name is Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, and of course you know he's the author of The Synagogue of Satan. We are, in my view, ladies and gentlemen, working towards some sort of terrible event here, it seems like, because as you are all aware, as the population in the United States and Europe becomes more and more informed about what happened on 9/11 and all of the things that have happened in our world of late, they're demanding answers from their politicians. And I've shared with you in the last file that the president of France has reached poll numbers, negative poll numbers, never before seen in the French presidency, which is an indication, ladies and gentlemen, that things are not being... the public is not accepting what they're being told on the news media, and it's happening in Britain, too, with Gordon Brown, happening in America. Now, this is a fatal flaw for the bad guys if we can continue to get the story out. So it seems to me they're going to probably try to ramp up some sort of activity soon, and it may be happening in the month of May, who knows. It looks like there's a lot of indications they'll try. But that being said, I want to bring up Andrew right away because his information is extraordinary. We're going to be starting with Andrew on page 89 if you bought the book. If not, just follow along on the website because, we put 30 pages of information up on the website as well. 1920 is the date we're going to be starting from. Andrew, are you with me?
Yes, I am, Daryl. Thank you for inviting me on your show again.
Well, you know, it's always a pleasure for me, Andrew. I mean, you know, you've been there for a long time, besides the French Connection, working really hard to tell people about just how terrible things have been in our world. You know, isn't it interesting that we all were kind of going along in life 15, 20 years ago, not even understanding the true roots of all the problems we were facing, and the Vietnam War, for example, 30, 40 years ago, the different problems, and now once you finally get the facts like we've been getting, it all makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
It does, and I think that the internet has blown that open for us, and so we've been able to, I think a lot of us have realised that things aren't the way that the media and the governments tell us for many years, but due to the resilience of the human spirit, as they chip away more against us and, you know, wages go down, prices go up, we just work harder and we always find a way to survive, and that's what these elite group have always depended on, the fact that they will just push us and push us and push us, knowing that we won't give up. And I think we're reaching a time in our history now where we are going to turn around and fight back and take the power that these people have basically obfuscated from us.
Well, you know, as a young man, it was easy for a father to come home with a paycheck and support a household. Today, if a husband and wife are not both working, they can forget about owning a home or having a car for travel or all those things, and it has changed so much. Let's go on right now to the 1920 period. We're going to open up with Winston Churchill, who, interestingly enough, has Jewish roots, doesn't he?
Yeah, the Churchill story is a very interesting one because, of course, what the listeners are going to find out about what we'll read out in a minute, which is a brief, well, it's actually an article that you can find on the internet that he wrote for the Illustrated Sunday Herald about Bolshevism and its root in the Jewish community. Of course, he went on to be the leader of the British forces, or the British government, if you like, in the Second World War. And we talk about him again later in this broadcast. But it appears that when he started off, he was essentially here was working as a journalist, and he was writing for this publication, revealing about this group things that they probably didn't want to be revealed. So he's probably one of these people that they've approached and made him that offer. I think Alan Greenspan apparently wrote a book in the 60s that I think you can find in various places online where he talks about the only solution to a the finances is a gold standard. And of course, then he goes completely against that, as he's the chairman of the Federal Reserve for years.
Yeah, well,
so people can be bought, and I believe both of these were.
You know, his statement about the Jews being the most remarkable race the world that has ever appeared on the world, I don't believe him. I don't believe that statement in any way. I believe they basically are the most sinister group that's ever come onto the world. And because human beings always want to believe the best about other people, when you approach life in a sinister manner, you are automatically an aggressor and a parasite. And I think they're the most parasitic the world has ever seen, so I don't trust his take on the Jewish community at all, the Zionist Jewish community, that is.
No, I agree with you, but of course he came from, he was certainly not brought up in, he was brought up in quite a wealthy upbringing, and he presumably looked at these people and being brought up in that way of life, and that being the norm and what you're really after in life, as much money as you can get, when you can see the influence that this group is managing to exert and the power that they're getting and the way that they're doing things, to him he probably thought it was a great thing and he hoped to be a part of it, and eventually he was.
Yeah, man. Well, we've got people just after this time frame, or the beginning of this time frame, the big influence of his day were, of course, Karl Marx and Trotsky and Rosa Luxemburg and Emma Goldman. These are all very powerful names in the ideology side of this Bolshevik Jewish conspiracy that was foisted upon the world at the beginning of the last century. You want to discuss a little bit about that and about some of the roots of that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the one that took hold that everyone is aware of is Russia, but we also had communism being spread in Hungary by Bela Kun, which was a crypto Jewish name, the real name was Cohen. Rosa Luxemburg was in Germany, and Emma Goldman was in the United States. And this is part of Churchill's article.
Yeah.
And the idea was they were pushing an overthrow of civilization and the reconstruction of society. Essentially, in the communist form, which we are well aware of, that they will get the masses, if you like, riled up and to say, look, you know, we demand this, that and the other, and these communists will come in and say, you know, you're being so badly treated and come with us and, you know, we'll give you so much more than you're getting now. And then when they do support the communists use them to gain the power, and so the people, these are the same people that are going to die fighting the troops of a country, etc., etc. And then whoever's left, the communists will then rule them, and the communists will just you keep all the wealth for themselves, and these people are even more downtrodden than they were initially. But the key is that they use their manipulation to promise the masses that they will deliver them more than the current system does. And once they have got the masses to essentially overthrow the current system and they take hold of it, they become the most repressive system of all, banning free speech, committing all sorts of atrocities on the people that question them in any way whatsoever. And this is the same as, you know, socialism, communism, all this is very much linked, and it's just the left-right paradigm, if you like, of people thinking the right is all about capitalists and the left is all about helping the working class. The truth is both systems are about helping the elite, and they just manipulate, they just flip-flop from one to the other, whichever suits them at the time.
I think you're exactly right about that, and September 10th edition of the American Hebrew talks about the brains behind communism and the Russian Revolution being entirely Jewish, and what we do know today is that $20 million and 4,000 Jews left New York on a ship and arrived in Russia and became the elites, and they were sent there by Brandeis and Morgenthau and others at the behest of the Rothschild fortune, were they not?
Yeah, I mean, it was shift money, as we know. But of course, shift money is Rothschild money. It's funny that I just stumbled upon this because it suddenly reminds me I spent ages trying to find the author for this quote, and I could only find the edition of the American Hebrew. But what it actually states in this September the 10th edition is the Bolshevist revolution in Russia was the work of Jewish brains, of Jewish dissatisfaction, of Jewish planning, whose goal is to create a new order in the world. What was performed in so excellent a way in Russia, thanks to Jewish brains and because of Jewish satisfaction and by Jewish planning, shall also, through the same Jewish mental and physical forces, become a reality all over the world. And this is something that, you know, on the previous show we discussed Paul Wahlberg addressing Congress and saying we will have a world government either by something like that, or by conquest. So it's basically either you give in to a world government or we will fight you to get one.
Well, there's another book that comes out at the same time by H.A. Gwynn, The Cause for World Unrest, and it discusses the use of royal structure and the old system of controlling countries through heritage and moving into this new paradigm where a geopolitical structure put under the control of a race of people begins to take hold. And it's interesting how this this book discusses how the Jews start rising up from being the principal merchants of an era and move into the controllers of the world.
Yes, I mean, you know, we this is something that we will see how it develops from the first Rothschild, but what essentially is going on about here is that we've got a group that have managed over a period of time to get control of money, and now they're able to use that money to destroy any of the existing order, be that kings, queens, governments, with the money that they have. Money is power. And they're able to use that as ruthlessly as they wish in order to gain this power. And the quote I use from this book essentially outlines that as to, again, points to the fact that it is chiefly Jewish, is his quote.
Well, you're hitting the nail on the head with that one. And here's the interesting thing, too. 1920 was the first year the public in Britain actually got to read the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And of course, as soon as it became a public issue, the Zionist Jews in charge of Britain came out and called everybody who was discussing this particular document anti-Semites. Of course, which is the first time they really pulled out the anti-Semite card to quash an idea. Now, what had happened was, and of course, you know. It was deemed a forgery, the original document, but of course we all know a forgery is a replica of the original, and you say in your book that they could not go as far as saying it was a fake, because the fact was, it wasn't a fake. It was a real document that was just transcribed from an original.
Yes, I mean, you know, the reason that they've done that is a lot of people, when they hear the word forgery, they automatically think, oh, forgery means it's not true. Because their brain doesn't, you know, it's a very clever word, forgery, because if something's forgery, you know, it's essentially, another word for forgery is fraud. Like, you know, if you forge a dollar note, it's fraud, and then fraud can be similar to fake, and so people, they used quite a clever word there. They didn't go and say it was fake. The protocols are something that I kind of feel now, I mean, I believe them to be real. The reason I believe them to be real is it would have to be written by someone extremely prophetic. The fact that they came out when they did, before the media power got in, before this real this net really encompassed the whole world. It was, there are too many things in the protocols that hadn't already happened when they came out, in my opinion, for them to be a fake, for them to have been written by someone who didn't like the Jews and just had an idea, I'm going to write this. Too much has come true that wasn't true at that point, in my opinion, for them not to be true. But Henry Ford, I think for any of the listeners that haven't really made their mind up about this, I think Henry Ford's quote in 1921 really sums it up. He said, the only statement I care to make about the protocols is that they fit in with what is going on. They are 16 years old and they have fitted the world situation up to this time. They fit it now. And he would be saying the same thing if he was alive today. They fit it greater now than they did then.
That's right. Well, it's a perfect example of the 20th century if you take a look at what's happened. And so, I mean, how can anybody, actually make the case that it's not real? I it's amazing to me. One of the next things is really important in your book. You talk about Jacob Schiff being involved in the formation and foundation, the founding of the CFR. Now, you and I both know that there are people out there in the alternative media that keep saying that the Jews have no involvement, or if they do, they're only peripherally involved in CFR, Bilderberg, and the rest. What we've got here in your book is a clear statement saying that CFR was in fact constructed and formed by Jewish influence. And could you speak to that for us?
Yes, I mean, essentially, I think with the CFR, what we've got to be aware is, same with the Bilderberg Group and the World Institute for International Affairs, these are all groups formed by Jews, but principally the people that they put in them are going to be high up people at the forefront of business, politics, etc. Because the idea is that they want to show that there's these hidden groups controlling the world, and they want to stand behind those groups but not really show that they're too much of a part of those groups. And so when people expose the group, then they unleash, they undercover one layer of the onion, as it were, and they think, oh, we know who rules the world, we know who's behind all this. It's the Council on Foreign Relations, or it's the Bilderberg Group, and people don't look behind that and see who formed these groups. And what we've got here is we've got Jacob Schiff in 1921 actually ordered the formation of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Bernard Baruch and Colonel Edward Mandel House, is a very sort of shady character, undertook his instructions to set it up. And it was agreed to be set up on May the 30th, 1919, at the Hotel Majestic in Paris. And at the start of it, it was about 1,000 people in the USA, because the CFR is basically the US arm, if you like, and you've got the Bilderberg and the Royal Institute of International Affairs being the European one. The membership at the start was included virtually every industrial empire in America, all the American-based international bankers, and the heads of all their tax-free foundations. And so what you have was this big pool of money that future presidential candidates, etc., would need to tap in order to get support for their campaigns.
What it allowed them, Andrew, if you'll allow me to interject here, is to be one step away from the controllers, from the real criminals. Allow them cover for an organization to go out and do their bidding, so that they as a group or a race or a force are somewhat opaque in the identification.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's all about them putting these other people in front. They know that they always know that things are going to get exposed, and so the key is, it's like the banking setup in Switzerland, where you've got front company after front company after front company, and so it's very difficult to tie. For example, the Rupert Murdoch fortune is actually Rothschild, and he's just their front man. And this is the way that they've done it here. They know that things will be exposed by elements of the media that they don't control, etc., etc., people speaking out. And so what they do is that they set up these organizations so that they can essentially be making the decisions, just the same as the government today, the people that say it's all George W. Bush. I mean, it's whoever's, there's people behind him, the neocons, and there's people behind them, the bankers, but people only go as far as George W. Bush. They know that this technique works because they control the media, and so they can then point the finger at the person who's going to be expendable, and it will never be this elite Zionist group.
That's exactly right, Mom. And you know, it is one of the most difficult concepts for people to wrap themselves around, and it has been the most. It has been my focus to expose those links. And, of course, people like, and I'm going to say it in this file, Alex Jones will not make the jump. And what he does is he stops you at the door of this group and ends it with Bilderberg, ends it with CFR, ends it with Roundtable, ends it with Illuminati, and says, and then continues to call it a New World Order while, of course, you know it's a term used in their... In their pronouncements, it certainly is not identifying the perpetrators as from an Ashkenazi Zionist Jewish bent. Now, I've made some discoveries of late, Andrew, that say that there are also a great number of Sephardic Jews also involved in this. And to stop at Ashkenazis, it seems to me to actually be not be telling the entire story.
No, that's very possible. I mean, when I did my research into this area, it is difficult that the overlap between the two, the Sephardic and the Ashkenazi. Of course, we've got the Ashkenazis being up to 90% of the Jews in the world today. And then when you look at all the Israeli presidents, prime ministers, etc., they all appear to have been the Ashkenazis. And so I went down that sort of line. But certainly, when you look at the way that Jews intermarry with other races, something that the some of them really are very upset about. But we know in America, so I believe there are more Jews marrying outside of their race than there are within it.
Yeah.
So clearly, this is nothing new. And the Sephardic group, there may well have been elite families in that group that became part of this group. I'm satisfied the Rothschild family, who I believe are the real nucleus of the group, are are actually Ashkenazi. But what people speak about a lot is the fact that Rothschild had his five sons, if you like, but they forget that he also had five or six daughters. And these are never talked about, and this is where I think you're going to find your Bush lines and people like this. It's going to be one of the daughters, and they've married into these other wealthy families. And this is what interests me, is to really look at the female line of this family and see what families they married into. And I think you will find it will lead to a lot of our big name figures in the public eye today.
Well, you know, you also find within the Sephardic group a lot of Portuguese names. When I put up that article about the slave trade, one of the richest men in the colonies before it became America, before it came to the United States, was a guy named Lopez. And of course, you'll look through Hollywood and find names like Garcia, and names like Diaz, and names like Alfonso, and you'll find that in many instances they're actually Sephardic Jews from the Spanish side of the Murano connection. But that's for another debate or another discussion in the future. What I'd like to talk about now is Theodore Roosevelt. Now, this guy was an absolute worker for them in that he was putting into practice in government, in the United States government, all the demands of the Rockefeller fortune and the Carnegie and the Mellon fortune in world politics, and doing it in the American hemisphere. Of course, working his criminality in Cuba and throughout the United States. What did you find when you looked into Roosevelt and then his subsequent death in 1922?
Well, with Roosevelt, he clearly knew about this issue. And, of course, there was the breakup of Standard Oil, supposed to be broken up because it was anti-competition, but, of course, they still all linked together.
Yep.
I believe he was around at the time that happened. But, incidentally, in 1919, he was quoted in the New York Times, March the 27th, as saying, these international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of newspapers and the columns of these newspapers. To club into submission or drive out of public office officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques which compose the invisible government. So even talking then about an invisible government. So he, you know, it's no doubt that he was aware of it without this quote, but this is something that he's been quoted as coming out with in the paper there.
Well, yeah, now we move on here to 1922 again. Of course, the New York Times talking here about, he says that the mayor of New York, John Hyden, who had been reported in the same paper the previous day, with the following statement, the warning of Theodore Roosevelt has much timeless today, for the real menace of our republic is the invisible government. Now, at the same time, Rockefeller is talking about, Roosevelt is talking about the Standard Oil fortune. It is his same government is allowing them to stay linked behind the scenes, which is exactly what you just said. So it was a deception back then, because everybody was feeling pressured by the monopoly that had been formed. So what they seem to have done here, Andrew, is throw everybody a bone by saying, look, we've broken them up. But when you take a look at the way they broke them up, there was really no separation of the power structure in any way.
No, absolutely. It was all done for show. I mean, the other interesting thing here is, of course, that, again, this is a deception they're doing, because they're saying, oh, it's the Rockefellers. So it's like, oh, we'll give them the Rockefellers, when really we know that the Rockefellers won't exist without the Rothschilds, who fronted them up.
Well,
and so again, they're steering away from this Zionist core. Of course, now they won't really push at Rockefeller, because Rockefeller's higher up there. They've got more people built below him now. But at the same time, they're prepared to sort of point to certain people, so long as it never goes, but you'll never find it pointed at Rothschild. It just never happens.
Well, we've got this concept of crypto Jew returning over and over again. Of course, if you go back in history, back to Sabbatai C, saying that he became a Muslim when he never did, or you look into the Marano Jews, as we just discussed a moment earlier, or even how about to General Clark being Jewish, or Madeleine Albright being Jewish, or Howard Dean being Jewish, or how about Al Gore, his marriage and his family to a Schiff, or how about, you know, the Bushes disguising themselves in their connections. What we find is this repeats over and over again. The question has to be asked, what are they hiding from? What are they ashamed of? Why are they trying to disguise the fact that they are Jewish? Because it's not necessary in America, of course. America, the Jews have had free access to power, and take a look at it. They run everything, so, you know, there's no restriction to them having power. What they were trying to do is disguise the fact that they have all the power. And you want to discuss that, what the book here says, Hilary Belloc's book on the Jews.
Well, yes. I mean, this is really the key that people have to look at. If it doesn't mean anything, why are they hiding it? I mean, even Hillary Clinton, she's come out and admitted that it was brought out that she was Jewish, and she came out and said, yeah, her grandmother was Jewish, and they even spoke Yiddish at home. But again, this is something that she didn't reveal. She actually revealed it when she ran for New York, because she knew it would help her vote, but decided not to beforehand. I think, again, I mean, I don't understand it. I mean, I was told, for example, by my own father, actually, that when I was bringing this book out, oh, make sure you use a pseudonym, don't use your real name, or things like that, because, you know, this, that, and the other, it's controversial. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, then I'm not going to be a coward and hide for it. So as soon as I was said that, told that, not only did I use my own name, but I put a photo on the back so people can see who I am, simply because I'm prepared to put this stuff together. I'm very satisfied that this is the truth, and I'm not going to hide behind another name to do that. But what these people seem to do is that they don't want anyone to realise that they've got a Jewish name, and if this wasn't significant, why do they do it? This is the case in point. And what Hilaire Belloc in his book, The Jews, which was published in this year, that we're talking about, which is 1922, he says, on talking about the crypto Jew, take the particular trick of false names. It seems to us particularly odious. We think when we show our contempt for those who use this subterfuge that we are giving them no more than they deserve. It is a meanness we associate with criminals and vagabonds, a piece of crawling and sneaking. Men whose race is universally known will unblushingly adopt a false name as a mask and after a year or two pretend to treat it as an insult if their original and true name be used in its place.
And isn't that a fact that we are facing today in almost every nation? Now, I'll give you an example here where Nicolas Sarkozy claims to be Christian and actually makes the sign of the cross and the whole bit. And here his grandfather was a principal behind the Salonika Greece lodge that took over the Ottomans. And he was a major member of the Jewish community there. And his mother's Jewish, and, you know, ipso facto, here we are with this man. And of course, everyone in his administration, almost to a person, is Jewish. So, again, we face this crypto approach, and if you question it, you get attacked as an anti-Semite.
Yes, and I think, again, what it boils down to is, if it's not significant, why do they have to lie about it? Why do they have to pretend to be someone else? Mm. If it's not relevant or significant. And the other interesting point here that Hilaire Belloc goes on to talk about is, he says, the Jew might almost be called a British agent upon the continent of Europe and still more in the near and far east. He was admitted to every institution in the state, a prominent member of his nation, became chief officer of the English executive, and an influence more subtle and penetrating began to take place wholesale between what had once been the aristocratic territorial families of this country, the UK, and Jewish commercial fortunes. After two generations of this, with the opening of the 20th century, those of the great territorial English families in which there was no Jewish blood were the exception. In nearly all of them was the same more or less marked, in some of them so strong that though the name was still an English name and the tradition those of a purely English lineage of long past, the physique and character had become wholly Jewish, and the members of the family were taken for Jews whenever they travelled in countries where the gentry had not yet suffered or enjoyed the admixture. So this is an extremely important point, because what he's saying is that the Jews married into these aristocratic families. I mean, in my research myself, it's very likely that Prince Philip is Jewish.